for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. In his first visit to New Orleans since taking office, President Obama announced a new working group to coordinate restoration projects along the Gulf Coast. The administration and congressional Democrats fire back at an insurance industry report that says comprehensive health legislation would cause premiums to climb sharply, and the Dow tops 10,000 despite concerns over rising unemployment. Joining us for our Friday News Roundup, David Wellner of NPR, Jackie Combs of The New York Times, John Dickerson of CBS, and Slate.com. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also reach us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Diane.
David Wellner, talk about the importance of the Senate Finance Committee finally voting out a health care bill.
Well, this moves the process forward into the stage where both the House and the Senate are trying to marry together the various committee bills that have now been approved. There are five of them, three in the House, two in the Senate. The action was really in the Senate this week with Harry Reid beginning backroom negotiations with the two chairmen of the committees in the Senate that have approved bills, one being the Finance Committee. And his challenge is really to try to figure out how to come up with a Harry Reid healthcare bill that is going to hold together the 60 members of his Democratic coalition, because Republicans have already made clear that they do plan to use a filibuster if they have the numbers to do it to keep this from moving forward. Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, is talking about spending 2 months on the Senate floor debating this, and the only way you cut off debate is with 60 votes. So Reid's challenge is to try to find something that is going to keep both liberals and centrists on board, and maybe even pick up a few Republicans.
An awful lot has been made, Jackie Combs, of Olympia Snowe's vote. In fact, you've got some Democrats complaining she is now the point person and leading the arguments.
Well, there's no question she has more leverage than just about any single person in Congress, and has had for some time. And, you know, there will also be outreach perhaps to some other moderates in both parties. They need to, as David said, keep on board some of the moderate Democrats and some of the few remaining moderate Republicans, like her fellow senator from Maine, Susan Collins, who expressed some interest this week. She wasn't on in the committees that dealt with the bill, but now as it moves to the floor, you know, she's speaking out and saying that, you know, she might be interested. Interesting. There's a real sense of momentum, but there is a lot of work to be done. I think the 60 votes is definitely a hurdle, but I think what you'll see is if there's some Democrats that in the end can't vote for this, they will at least vote to give for the 60 votes to shut down debate and get to a vote and take this bill up, even if they have to vote against it or feel they have to vote against it on final passage.
John Dickerson.
Well, one interesting signal we saw in the Senate Finance Committee vote this week is we had all of the Democrats voting for it. There was some talk a week or so ago that maybe some of the Democrats who were particularly fond of the public option might not vote for this in committee, but in the end, you know, the momentum of history and sort of party loyalty all went with them. So those kinds of things can start to kick in and be at play here as this moves closer to the finish line as well.
There's one big question, and that is whether there's going to be a public option in the Senate bill that Reid is trying to put together right now. When he brings it to the floor, which would mean that it would take 60 votes to take it out of the bill, or if he's going to send a bill to the Senate floor without it, and the proponents of a public option would have to muster 60 votes to put it in. Of course, that would be a much taller task for them
to
do.
What are the indications right now?
Well, Reid keeps saying that he personally is for a public option. At the same time, he has to worry about losing someone like Olympia Snowe, because she's already said that she does not support a pure public option, only a triggered public option.
A trigger. Explain that trigger, John Dickerson.
Well, there are a lot of different kinds of triggers. And one of the things here before I explain the trigger is that this may come down to a language debate. And the convincing Olympia Snowe may be about convincing Olympia Snowe to let the phrase public option be used for her trigger proposal, which is really not a public option at all. But a trigger essentially allows a public option-like animal to kick in at some point once it has been triggered by a lack of competition. And this can be done based on there's a discussion now about a public option where this trigger would kick in if a state has where 5% of the population doesn't have true choice, and that would kick in a public option. And then there's another notion being floated that would allow states, that would just give states the freedom, regardless of this 5% trigger, to have a public option, that it would not be national, but it would just be by state. And then finally, we've heard also about co-ops, which is another public option-like animal, which passed in the Finance Committee bill.
So it's all still very much up in the air, Jackie.
Oh, it is. And I think, you know, the one thing about all this talk about a public option, even if they were to solve that, there's a couple other really big problems. And I think the one that people haven't been focusing enough on is the difference is how to finance this, in keeping with President Obama's directive that it not add to the deficit and that it not be more than $900 billion over 10 years. The House wants, both the House and Senate Democrats want to have a significant amount, hundreds of billions in savings from Medicare, which mainly would come out of providers, insurance companies, doctors, hospitals, in ways that aren't expected to cut benefits despite the Republican attacks. For instance, if you have more people insured, you no longer have to pay hospitals to a payment that they now get to offset their costs of treating the uninsured, to offset the hospital's loss of money for those services.
But we've been hearing and hearing and hearing that Medicare beneficiaries are going to lose a great deal if this bill goes through.
Well, what really isn't explained is that the savings from Medicare are from a reduction in the growth of Medicare spending. In fact, they would represent maybe 3 or 4% of the projected spending over the next 10 years for Medicare. So it's just reducing an expansion of that spending. But another thing about Medicare that's going on right now in Congress is that under a formula that was cooked up in 1997 for Medicare, doctors are actually seeing the prospect of their payments being cut by 21% next year if Congress doesn't do anything. And of course, right now, it's already difficult in some parts of the country for older people to find doctors willing to care for them at Medicare rates. So Congress has to fix this. And the big question is that going to be part of this health care overhaul, or is that going to be a separate thing? And the Senate is set to take up a completely separate bill, a 10-year fix of this, that would cost $240 billion and not pay for a cent of it with any kind of revenue. And that's going to be a big problem with the House, because you have a lot of blue dogs in the House who say, Only what's paid for, and that's it, just as with the health care bill.
Here's why this is so important. They're trying to make the so-called doctor fix, which is basically undoing a promise that the members of Congress made in 1997. It was an effort to contain costs, and every year they've said, okay, well, we won't cut doctor payments this year because it's just too painful. And what's happened is those delayed cuts have accumulated. Now it's this big, huge 21% cut. Well, you know, it looks like they're not going to make that cut again. Why is this important? Because at the center of the healthcare reform and a lot of the fixes being talked about in this comprehensive reform are promises future Congress has to keep in order to keep the savings within the targets the president has set. And that is a hard thing to promise.
Tell me about the role that industry, the insurance industry, and special interest groups have played in the debate so far and will play as the bills go forward. John?
Well, the special interest groups, one of the things that's been particular about this effort at reform that was different than 1994 is a lot of the special interest groups were inside the tent. They were participating. They were either participating in good faith, or they weren't spending money on studies or television ads to knock down reform. We now see that changing a little bit. And we saw the insurance industry come out with a study that said your premiums are going to go up, I think it was $4,000 or $5,000 or $3,000 to $4,000. $1,000
the vote.
A year on the eve of the vote, which was then roundly criticized both by partisans, but then also by independent fact checkers, basically shooting the studies full of holes. And this was a last minute effort by the insurance industry. It has backfired in a way. And now House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is saying, look, at this is yet another example of how badly the insurance companies behave. And to punish them, we can do a number of things. We can take away their antitrust exemption, but also it's even a greater argument for the public option, a full, robust public option, because that would put pressure on these mean old insurance companies.
Jackie?
I think it's the consensus is pretty clear that the insurance companies have really, and their lobby have really blown it in the past week. They come to this debate without much credibility to begin with. If you, all the polls suggest about people's views of the different players in the healthcare system, and then they put out these studies that are suspect, to say the least, and have been immediately put down by respectable analysts, and so, you know, what they've done is they've stoked the arguments for the liberals who want a public option, who say, well, the premiums are, you know, the insurance company says the premiums are going to go this much up this high if this bill passes, then okay, then that's all the more argument for a public option to compete with private insurance in these exchanges to help bring rates down. So they haven't really done themselves any good whatsoever.
One other thing I would add, another group to look at is the doctors, and this goes back to David's point, which is if they fix this question of payments that are these proposed cuts, if they fix that, then doctors might become big fans of healthcare reform.
John Dickerson, chief political correspondent for Slate.com, political analyst, contributor to CBS, Jackie Combs, New York Times, David Wellner of NPR. Stay with us. Welcome back to our Friday News Roundup. In this hour, focusing on domestic issues with John Dickerson of Slate.com and CBS, Jackie Combs of the New York Times, David Wellner, he's congressional correspondent for National Public Radio. Here's an email from Betsy in Ypsilanti, Michigan, saying, wouldn't the trigger take place right away? Does the trigger depend on Congress to go into effect? If not, is it automatic? Who decides? I think there's a lot of confusion out there. What is the trigger based on, David Wellner?
Well, we don't even have a healthcare bill, much less a trigger as part of that bill. But what's been talked about, what Olympia Snow is endorsing, is the idea of letting the states have these healthcare insurance exchanges for some period of time. And if in these states you find that it is not reducing the premiums, then you would have a trigger go into effect,
but
where you would have a public
heavens,
option.
That could take years to figure out.
Well, nothing in this bill is going to take effect right away. There's a phase in. It's 2013, 2014 before presumably this would take effect no matter which bill you look at. And then a trigger by definition comes after something. And if something doesn't happen, right. then the trigger.
Right.
Although there has been some talk about having it kick in states where there 5% or greater of the population doesn't have access to a variety of choices. And presumably that would be you'd be able to figure that out at the front end.
But wouldn't that then sort of separate states one from another and create a bigger mess than what we've already got?
There's a question of what the critical mass would be that you'd need for a public option
right.
for it to have the kind of bargaining power that could force down premiums.
And we've had for decades, I mean, our system is such that states regulate insurance companies for the most part. So we already have a patchwork quilt of 50 separate insurance
systems. And that's why an awful lot of people are saying it's time for something bigger and something that envelops
right.
everyone. Okay, let's talk about the economy. The Dow topped 10,000 for the first time in a year. It's a little down this morning, but how important a milestone is that considering what's happening in the rest of the economy, Jackie?
Well, there's different ways to look at this. It's a good milestone if you're looking for signs that the economy is recovering. Much of this increase in the stock market is due to some really fantastic profits at some of the biggest financial institutions, which received federal money. But those were the institutions that were healthier going into the crisis in the first place. It's not so good a milestone from the standpoint that in a recovery, the market tends to recover before anything else. What doesn't recover until everything else has happened is the employment picture. So the problem politically, when you already have a sort of populism taking hold in this country from left to right, is that the country sees these fabulous profits from financial institutions that were getting bailed out, the system was getting bailed out just a year ago. And meanwhile, unemployment is still inching up. It hasn't peaked yet and probably won't until it gets over 10% next year. So this is a real problem politically and is going to force action, I think, on some additional stimulus measures before too long.
Well, what about this $250 per Social Security recipient in place of a cost of living increase?
Well, that's a... It's a tricky little and clever little political move. What's happened on the one front is seniors will not, for the first time since 1975, get a cost of living increase. That's because the Social Security Administration has determined that there has been so much deflation that there is no reason to give a cost of living increase. Those increases are supposed to keep seniors at parity in terms of their ability to purchase things. So in fact, from an economic standpoint, giving no increase in the cost of living actually because of deflation means that seniors have more purchasing power. That is maybe a policy argument. It is a loser as a political argument. And so the president has suggested a $250 infusion. It's about $13 to $14 billion.
Where is that money coming from?
Well, from the magical asterisk place. No one quite knows yet. And this, again, is another instance in which here we have the you might want to call them bureaucrats, call them whatever you want, but the people who understand the policy saying there's no reason for an increase. But the politicians are saying, yes, there is. And this is just the same kind of thing in the healthcare reform. All of these cost containment measures rely on future members of Congress sticking to the kinds of agreements that they're blowing willy-nilly today.
Jackie.
You have in this case, I mean, if the argument for it is that it's stimulative, then as a matter of economics, you wouldn't want to be offsetting the cost because you want to get money into the economy. Reducing the deficit takes it out. The problem is we're in this very odd place right now where there's very much worry about the deficits and the debt and a lot of talk of bringing that down. At the same time, we're still coming out of the worst recession since the Depression. And so it makes for a very tricky fiscal policy.
And here's an email that came in even before the show got on the air. It's from Brad in Salt Lake City, who says, can someone explain to me why Bank of America is set to lose $1.2 billion and yet is on track to dole out $30 billion in bonuses? while I think the bonuses are exorbitant to begin with, it seems like they could pare it down to $28.8 billion in bonuses, so they aren't losing money. Am I just naive? David Wellner.
Well, I think the problem with all of this is that these are contracts that these institutions have locked themselves into. The only way to really abrogate those contracts is for them to go bankrupt. And these were institutions that the government considered too big to fail. There are a lot of small banks that have failed all across the country. They weren't getting the super bonuses, but that's the contractual kind of society we live in. And even though it looks terrible, these people are, I guess, that they don't feel so ashamed that they're not taking the money.
But it is something to try the temper of even the greatest Zen master, because it's not only Bank of America. A lot of these firms, J.P. Morgan, which made a great deal of money, is making money based on basically the same kinds of behaviors that put us in the fix we've been in for the last year. And so and now Wall Street is offering bonuses across the board and across a number of banks that are at levels or greater than they were in 2007 during the go-go days.
And meanwhile, David Wellner, why is legislation on unemployment benefits stalled in the Senate?
Well, the person who is standing in the way of bringing up the extension of the unemployment benefits, which would benefit all the states, those states with unemployment levels above 8.5% would have a slightly longer period of extension, is Tom Coburn, Republican from Oklahoma. And his argument is that, okay, if we are going to spend this money on extending these benefits, let's take it from the stimulus bill that was approved last spring. Only 40% of that money has been spent so far. Let's do that. And Democrats have pointed out, well, actually, businesses pay money regularly into this unemployment insurance fund, and it's a dedicated fund. We're not losing any money taking this, but it's an argument about whether the government should be spending more money or not at a time when there are six people applying for every job that becomes available. And I think that Republicans are in danger of looking pretty bad on this at the same time that they're pounding Democrats for the fact that there aren't enough jobs.
John Dickerson, has Tom Coburn or any other prominent Republican spoken out against these bonuses that the big bankers are getting?
Well, they speak out against them, and they certainly have spoken out against the profligacy of bailouts. But it's not, that there is a disconnect here, and whether individuals look at particular lawmakers or not, these numbers that come out from Wall Street are just staggering. And that disconnect, it seems like we have another story of this every week.
All right. Let's give a special flag to Ken Lewis. He had agreed to make no salary and no bonus for 2009. He's Bank of America CEO. He said he'll return about $1 million, forego $500,000. Yet, he still walks away with $69.3 million in retirement benefits and unvested stock. Bank of America lost more than $2 billion in the third quarter due to greater loan losses that show consumers are still struggling to pay bills. I mean, there is a disconnect here, Jack.
Yeah, there certainly is, because, the headlines today are that he agreed to give up this 2009 pay, as you say. And he only apparently did so because we now have a pay czar. Kenneth Feinberg is reviewing all the top executives' pay agreements at the seven financial institutions that still have TARP funds. And so he got Mr. Lewis to agree to this. They say the money that he retires at the end of the year under a cloud because of Bank of America's deal to acquire Merrill Lynch and circumstances surrounding that. But they say this retirement package of tens of millions of dollars was, again, under a contract that predates the financial collapse. And it's based on his many years of service there. But, you know, it's, I mean, explain that, try explaining that to somebody and justifying that when you go out and the circumstances you do.
Dave.
We also have the case of Goldman Sachs, which was not a recipient of TARP money, but they yesterday reported a quarterly profit of $3.5 billion. They're setting aside close to $20 billion to pay out to their employees who would make an average of $700,000 each this year. And while it looks really bad, they are still planning to go ahead with them and to try to sort of soften the impact of that. They're talking now about increasing their charitable donations to foundations, that kind of thing. It's the kind of thing that Rockefeller realized a century ago that, you know, you look like you're a nice guy while you're hauling your money to the bank.
And just one, and one other point about these contracts, the special PASAR, Kenneth Feinberg, is trying to reduce the $198 million in bonuses that go to AIG. We all remember AIG. And again, he's having trouble because these contracts were signed before the catastrophes of the last year, which makes them difficult to fix.
Jackie?
You know, Goldman Sachs did get a little TARP money along with J.P. Morgan, and they both will tell you, and with, you know, some credibility, that they didn't really need the money. They took it because the government late last year asked them to, so that there wouldn't be a stigma to those companies, those banks and financial institutions that really did need the money. And they've since paid it back. That said, when you hear this, some of these institutions talk as if they, you know, they never were in that much trouble. The whole system was in trouble. The government, the combination of Treasury and the Federal Reserve, saved the entire financial system.
And you are listening to the Diane Rehm Show. What about the whole question of the stimulus for jobs? Where are we with that, David?
Well, it's a big argument that's going on right now. How many jobs were created because of the stimulus? How many more jobs might have been lost without it? Right now, the Obama administration is pushing the idea of giving a tax credit to businesses that create more jobs. This is something that on the surface looks very good. At the same time, in the execution, there could be lots of opportunities for fraud with this, people creating jobs that making two jobs out of what used to be one job and getting the tax credit for it. But they clearly feel that they have to do more than what the stimulus is doing right now, at least for the perception that they are about creating more jobs.
They have to do more and not call it stimulus, which just means we're in another one of these funny name games where there will be a series of different things that will be done. But because the first stimulus, because they don't want to talk about a second stimulus, they won't call it that.
And going back to what created all these problems in the first place, do any of you see a bigger push toward new regulation of these financial instruments that got everybody in trouble in the first place?
The House Financial Services Committee is moving forward on these unregulated, these derivatives, and the president went to Wall Street, I guess it was 2 weeks or 3 weeks ago, to make a renewed push for this. You know, most people have watched these regulations get watered down from their original design. And then there's the question of whatever passes in the House. The Senate has an even more watered down view. So it's A, moving slowly, and the reforms seem to be getting a little less strict than they were before.
And David Wellner, talk about the divisions between among Democrats over the president's consideration of a new strategy in Afghanistan.
We're seeing some very prominent Democrats who have been critics of the Iraq War and how President Bush handled that war, now coming out on the side of General McChrystal, the commander in Afghanistan, and his plea for more troops. Dianne Feinstein, the chairwoman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, a few weeks ago was telling me she had real misgivings about McChrystal's plan. She said, I want to know if this is a 10-year plan or not. And now she's saying, I think that we should listen to the general. Senator Daniel Inouye, the chairman of the Appropriations Committee, a war hero himself, and an influential voice with other Democrats, has also endorsed that view. At the same time, you have many other Democrats saying, wait a minute, we may be getting ourselves deeper into a quagmire in Afghanistan when the real problem seems to be Pakistan.
David Obey, the House chairman of the Appropriations Committee, is one of those Democrats saying it's $1 trillion potentially. Nancy Pelosi has been very hands-off in terms of scheduling a vote or whether a vote would succeed to pay for these new troops. And we have two debates going on here, of course. There's the debate among Democrats in Congress, and then there's the colossal debate going on inside the administration between the administration and the Pentagon. And then, finally, if you were to add one third complexity, although, of course, there are more, there's news of a potential runoff in Afghanistan. Right. Senator Levin yesterday said that the chairman of the Armed Services Committee said that what he sees is the president has to figure out whether to add more troops or not, but he has to wait until some kind of resolution comes out of the Afghan government picture, because you could see an instance in which the president adds more troops and the government continues to fall apart, and that's politically quite troublesome.
John Dickerson, Jackie Combs, David Wellner. They're here to answer your questions. Give us a call, 800-433-8850.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University. By the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. By the Gruber Family Foundation to extend the breadth and depth of NPR's international coverage. And by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. An IED kills four Americans in Afghanistan. A string of attacks in Pakistan leaves scores dead. And Turkey and Armenia take first steps toward reconciliation. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back to our Friday News Roundup, this week with David Wellner of NPR, John Dickerson of Slate.com and CBS, and Jackie Combs of The New York Times. Let's go first to Columbia, Missouri. Good morning, Brian. You're on the air.
Good morning. Spectacular program, timely and important as always.
Thanks.
I'd like to go to the healthcare issue. This country needs to show who we are and what we're about. This public health care thing. But what's really got me troubled is I don't remember the public electing Olympia Snow dictator of the health care effort. I don't understand. I'm to a point, I believe the only bipartisan thing that may happen on this is a filibuster.
Well, this is David Wellna. I think that the reason that there's such a focus on Olympia Snow is not that they need one Republican vote to get to 60 necessarily, but it's more that there are a number of conservative Democrats or Democrats who are very vulnerable and facing reelection bids next year, such as Blanche Lincoln of Arkansas, who would be able to point to Olympia Snow voting for this bill, saying, you know, even a Republican voted for this bill. Therefore, I felt I could support it. If Olympia Snow says, you know, I just can't sign on to that, that is just not good enough, it's going to be very difficult for some of those fence-sitting Democrats to sign on as well. That's why the focus is on Olympia Snow. The same thing happened with the stimulus bill earlier this year that Harry Reid ended up having to court several Republicans to put that over the top. At that point, he didn't have 60 members of his caucus, but the focus did end up being on those people who were really right at the margin. And in fact, when you have to get to 60 in the Senate, that's the game that you have to play.
Jackie.
And I think in fairness to Senator Snow, this bill wouldn't look a lot different if she weren't in the mix, because she is sort of a stalking horse, in effect, unintentionally on her part, maybe, for the moderate to conservative Democrats in the Senate who, you know, have the same concerns and the same political pressures.
All right. To Fernandina Beach, Florida. Good morning, Jim. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. And you've covered a lot of territory this morning. My comment is on the health care issue also, and it's sort of personal, but I retired 2 years ago after 40 years and have what I consider is good health care. But in the time since I've retired, the insurance companies have constantly had a plan to, I think, force people completely out of the program, especially the older ones. We just got a notice that in the next year, our 90% deductibility is going to 80%. Hmm. Doctor visits are going from $25 to $35. The payments that you do make, less and less, is going toward your deductibility. Now, when you retire, you're sort of out of the ball game, and you don't really have a lot to speak to say for it. But I'd like for your guest to comment, because the insurance companies, they are prepared. They have a ball game, and their ball game is to really transfer all the wealth from middle America, or anyone really, to their side of the board.
John Dickerson.
I would say a couple of things. One, the administration hopes that some of the tricks the insurance companies use to deny care or to deny coverage of care and essentially get between you and your doctor, they hope that this reform will fix some of those problems. As far as cost goes, they argue that for those without insurance who can go into these exchanges, that will create a level of competition so that insurance companies won't be able to change your coverage like that. Or if they do, you hopefully will have, at least in their theory goes, another insurance company you can go to that will cover you more fully. And so with that competition, it'll keep them honest.
Sort of lost in this discussion, though, about these public exchanges is that, in fact, only about 10% at the most of the population would even be eligible to take part in those public exchanges. So to the extent that a public option might remedy this problem, most people would not be eligible to be part of that public
option. And that's because it doesn't count the roughly 80% of people who have employer-provided insurance coverage.
All right. To Fort Worth, Texas. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning. Gosh, Rough Country is in quite a mess, aren't we? From one end to the other.
I understand your concern.
Very concerned. I have a couple of statements. I'm on Social Security, and I don't mind. I don't necessarily want the 250, but I don't mind the no cost of living, the cost of living raise. My problem with it is, where is Congress going to? Why aren't they cutting back on the federal level? It just irritates me to death. And also on health care, if there isn't a public option, it's just been a waste of time, a total waste of time. If they're just handing it back to the insurance companies, this has been going on for 30 years or more, and it just keeps getting worse, and nobody can get it under control. And look at them, the way they're, the nasty ads, the nasty things the Republicans are saying to save the insurance companies. You know, what's the point?
You know, Susan raises several really good points. Another person says, when America elected Obama as president, we voted yes to public insurance. So why are we having such a hard time getting it through Congress? Since his election, President Obama has said, if I had a clean slate to start with, that's what you'd get. Why didn't he say that in the election? I don't understand the turnabout.
Well, in the election, he did say, when asked about single payer, and Republicans tried to attack him and say, you see, he's really quietly for single payer.
He just doesn't want to say. He's a socialist. He's a communist.
That's right. And he said at the time, he said, you know, single payer, I still support the notion, but in the context of the uniquely American system with employer-provided health insurance, it just isn't gonna fly, and therefore we want this other thing. Just quickly on the politics of the public option, it just seems to me one of the things that will be most interesting here is for people like Susan, whether A, she can be convinced what's finally passed is a public option. In other words, the word game here. Is a trigger for her going to be sufficient public option? Secondly, if she doesn't like insurance companies, they so far, even without the public option, are the losers in the health care reform that have come out in the Baucus bill. There's about a $6 billion a year tax on insurance companies. They put out these studies because they're losing in the fight. So is, in terms of selling the plan, will pain to the insurance companies help tamp down on the feelings of people like Susan? I don't know. It's an open question.
David Wellnay, is or are members of Congress getting a cost of living increase?
Well, it's interesting. The very first appropriations bill that they finished this year and that got signed into law was the legislative one that keeps them in business. And, of course, I guess they could argue that if without them being in business, none of the other bills would be approved. But they did. There were significant increases for the staff expenditures of the various committees in Congress. The cost of living increase was kept down to simply that of inflation. But, of course, inflation was not that much last year. You heard leaders last year saying, at the time of the meltdown, saying, we don't think that the Congress should be getting any increase. But these increases are almost automatic now, and if they're not going to give it to seniors, it would look bad, I guess, for Congress to give it to themselves.
It would certainly look bad. Thanks for your call, Susan. Let's go to Grand Rapids, Michigan. Good morning, Michael.
Yes, thank you. I think there's two things that indicate that the politicians do not have any confidence in this bill, primarily, I guess, the Democrats, although this really isn't a Democrat-Republican point I'm trying to make. The first is they bend over backwards for Olympia Snow. And from what I remember, when tax cuts or really popular legislation goes through, one party loves to claim this is ours, the other party hates it, vote for us because we're the good guys trying to get this through. The fact that they're bending over backwards, trying to make this farce of bipartisanship when you have one person and that means it's bipartisan, means that the Democrats themselves think this is probably not going to work, and they want to share the blame when the costs explode or when it doesn't live up to what it stands for.
Well, that's an interesting perspective, John.
Yeah, I guess I just want to push back against this notion that they bent over backwards for Olympia Snow. They did want Olympia Snow. It's very important. It's important to the White House because the president ran as a post-partisan, bipartisan bridge builder. So it's not unimportant. But again, as we discussed earlier, Olympia Snow is representative of a larger viewpoint. The president's insistence on a bill that gets that's about $900 billion and that it be deficit neutral and that it try and bend the cost curve, which is to say deal with the long-term health care inflation. Those aren't just Olympia Snow's concerns. Those are the president's concerns. Those are the concerns of a number of moderate Democrats. It is those concerns that everybody has tried to meet. She agrees with those, but she also indeed agrees with what a lot of progressives agree with, which is that the subsidies in these bills for working families need to be increased, which is one of the tensions of Olympia Snow. She wants it to both be deficit neutral and she wants the subsidies to increase. So those two things are slightly at conflict.
Jackie.
And I would say in the realm of public policy, all of these problems in the country have been studied to death, and there's generally only so many ways to approach them, and healthcare is no different. It's very complicated, but what this bill, I think, is in fact a very moderate bill, so moderate that 15 years ago in 1994, it was very much a bill very much like this was introduced by 23 Senate Democrats, including Bob Dole, when they were coming up with an alternative to President Bill Clinton's bill, which, of course, failed.
You know, one thing we haven't talked about is the president's trip to New Orleans. He got there, first time there. A lot of people complain, especially on the Republican side, saying, how come this, he's waited so long to get down here? We have an email saying, by being the president, Obama did not need to go to New Orleans himself to be effective. He's delegated other officials some roles on New Orleans reconstruction. This is a lot different than a single individual campaigning for office. David.
Well, I think we can remember President Bush being fiercely criticized for flying over New Orleans right after Katrina hit that city and not going on the ground. And I think actually physically being there, delivering a speech, showing the flag, as it were, for Obama, it just shows that this is one of his concerns, and his promise to people yesterday was, I'm just getting started.
You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Jackie.
I think the listener is right that you know, how what's more important than a visit is how the administration is attending to the Gulf Coast reconstruction. And in that regard, yesterday, President Obama got a big compliment from Joseph Gao, the Republican congressman for the area, who, in fact, may be a one-term congressman because it's a very Democratic district. But he said that they'd had a much easier time of getting answers to their problems from this administration than the previous one. That said, I agree with David that a personal visit goes a long way in for a region like that was so badly hurt.
Lots of email on the Social Security one-time payment. This from Victoria in Rochester, New York. No raise in Social Security while inflation is flat does not mean more buying power for seniors. First, aren't Medicare premiums going up? Is that true?
They're being held harmless. That's another step that's being taken in
what
Congress.
Does that mean, held harmless?
That means that if normally they would go up, and because I'm trying to think where the legislation is at this point, but Congress has acted, the House has acted to keep Medicare premiums. There will be no change is the expectation next
year. Okay. She says that means seniors will have less money to start with, but you're correcting her and saying, as far as your understanding goes, right, there will be no increase in Medicare costs. All right. Let's go to Tulsa, Oklahoma. Good morning, Mike. You're on the air.
Good morning. I had one simple question. They defend paying bonuses to Wall Street executives because they sign contracts, but these same corporations don't have any problem breaking contracts with unions. So how come they're able to break union contracts, but they can't break these contracts that bind them to paying bonuses?
Interesting question. John Dickerson.
Well, I guess I should defend us first. I didn't hear any of us defending these one way or the other. I think what we were explaining is the fix that the government is in as it tries to go after these CEO pay packages. The government can't go in and abrogate these contracts.
Even Kenneth Feinberg can do that.
That's right. Although he's trying.
He's trying.
He's trying, but he's faced some hurdles, and that's just the legal system getting in his way.
David?
Yes, I mean, and the way he's trying is actually by reducing the benefit, the current payouts to these executives, and I guess trying to put the moral pressure on them to voluntarily reduce these big windfalls that they're locked into. It's going to have to be their initiative to do it, though, because as I said before, unless they go bankrupt, those contracts can't be broken.
The question we sort of been asking after each Friday News Roundup: how soon do you see Congress voting on health care reform, John?
Oh,
big sigh.
Yeah,
big
I think
sigh.
We're into December.
Into December.
Well, David, I guess the question is finishing. I'd say it's going to go right up to Christmas.
Jackie?
Yeah, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Jackie Combs of The New York Times, David Wellner of National Public Radio, John Dickerson of Slate.com, and CBS. I think we need to have some good news on one of these Friday News Roundups. Before long, I promise you we'll have some. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Anisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.